This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Negative campaigning often works even when it's based on lies and distortions. My guest, Kathleen Hall Jamieson, is a communications analyst who has studied why negative campaigning is so effective and why deceptive negative ads are so difficult to counteract. She's the author of the new book, Dirty Politics, Deception, Distraction, and Democracy. Jamieson is also dean of the Annenberg School of Communications at the University of Pennsylvania. She attended both the Republican and Democratic conventions and has been studying this year's negative campaigning. I realize that today may sound like NPR's salute to Kathleen Jamieson, since on some stations she was also coincidentally heard on the program Talk of the Nation. I spoke with her earlier today and asked her if the tactics used in negative ads are also used now in the general campaign.
The tactics of negative campaign ads actually came from regular campaigning. Historically, there's been a tendency in campaign discourse to simplify, to create artificial oppositions and artificial identifications, and then to identify your candidate with everything that's positive, your opponent with everything that's negative, and illegitimately contrast and compare. Those tactics move naturally from speeches, from the stump into advertising. They didn't move from advertising into the stump. But what advertising has done, particularly television advertising, is give the politician the ability to make those claims visual. And in the process of making those claims visual, what the candidate is able to do is to move with a speed that makes it hard for us to analyze what is being said. So I can juxtapose Hubert Humphrey's picture at the Democratic Convention of 1968 with Appalachian poverty so quickly that you're not likely to say, what are they doing together? And yet, you've now associated them in a way that means that the images have had an influence you might not have granted if I'd said, he's the cause of Appalachian poverty. He's indifferent to Appalachian poverty. He would tolerate Appalachian poverty.
There's an article in the New York Times today about how the Democrats are accusing the Republicans of using Hillary Clinton, working women in general, pro-choice women, and homosexuals as the new Willie Hortons. You've studied the Willie Horton ad. You've studied negative campaigning and negative advertising in general. Do you agree with the assertion?
The Horton claims in 1988 played on fears. The claims about liberated women, particularly the claims in the Marilyn Quayle speech, the claims about homosexuals, particularly the claims in the Buchanan speech, the claims about Hillary Clinton's positions on children's rights spread across the entire convention, play on fears. The Willie Horton instance was also based in factually inaccurate claims. The claims about Hillary Clinton's positions are factually inaccurate. The claim that Bill Clinton supports legalizing same-sex marriages is inaccurate. So to the extent that the Republican claims about working women, about Hillary Clinton, about gays, are playing on fears and based in factually inaccurate information, yes, there is a similarity.
You've studied the Willie Horton ad. Let's look at how that worked, how it worked psychologically on the people who watched it, because you even did focus groups to see what people took away from that Willie Horton campaign. Let's start with the information that was presented in it. What was accurate? What was inaccurate?
The Horton ad itself says that Horton stabbed a young man 19 times, killing him. Horton did not, as best we can tell, stab the young man. Instead, one of the people involved in the crime testified that Horton was in the car shooting up dope while the other two botched the robbery and killed the young man. If that is true, then what we have is a claim in the ad that's false. Horton did not kill the young man. Now, under Massachusetts law, he is nonetheless guilty of murder because he's an accessory to a felony murder. And so one can say he's a murderer. At least he's an accessory to a felony murder. He's convicted of first-degree murder. One cannot say he did the killing. But the larger inaccuracy in the use of Horton occurs when the Republican ad, the furlough ad that shows the supposed criminals revolving through a door, which is actually a turnstile, that ad amalgamates for us, invites us to amalgamate what we know of Horton with the claim in the ad that says many first-degree murderers escaped. Many went on to commit crimes like kidnapping and rape. Now, many first-degree murderers didn't escape. Four did in the 10 years that we had data on. Five actually did. One person escaped within the campaign year. Of those five, only one committed a violent crime, Horton. That is also the only black first-degree murderer who escaped. The most interesting of the cases the Republicans didn't use was a white cop who killed his business partner for the insurance money, his white business partner. Most murders are between people who know each other. Most murders are interracial. I'm sorry, most murders are within the same race. They're not between different races. And then this white cop went and killed another cop. And so what you had was a very inflammatory case that was available. The Republicans didn't use it. And when they were pressed in 88, the reason they said they used Horton was because he committed a violent crime. Horton is the only one who ever did who was a first-degree murderer.
I'm going to stop you right here because I think you've just illustrated a very important problem. What you're doing, in a way, is illustrating the problem of combating negative ads. Mm-hmm. To explain the false information in the Willie Horton ad requires, one, investigating the real story, which apparently you did, and two, unraveling complicated information, like what he was actually convicted of, what actually happened that we know at the scene of the crime, what was contested in the courtroom, who else was in the furlough program, and how did they do, and so on. It's complicated. It's much easier to just get this kind of visceral snapshot from an ad and form an impression than to actually sit down and examine the facts and sift through information and reconsider, you know?
And when the analytic information is offered, the statistical information is offered, against the atypical but dramatic and vivid personal case, Horton, people don't remember the statistical data and they don't believe that the case is atypical. We tend as individuals to generalize from single dramatic instances, particularly simple dramatic instances that play on our fears. Our fears say blacks kill whites, black men rape white women. What's the allegation against Horton? He killed a white young man. He raped a woman while on furlough, and the woman was white. And so out of the dramatic narrative, we have a coherent story that plays on deep-seated fears. We believe it's typical, and no statistical data will displace that. That's what we found in our focus groups. We offered one of our focus groups in Texas all the available evidence. The furlough program in Massachusetts had a 99.9% success rate. When you're given furloughs, you are more likely not to repeat crimes. You're more likely not to come back to a life of crime. That's the reason every state has a furlough program. That's the reason the federal government continues a furlough program. We laid all of this out. The only person to commit a violent crime, Horton, and then said to people who had said they were influenced by the story, what's your reaction? They said, none of that matters. And then they went back and replayed the Horton story for us. What we concluded was the appropriate way strategically for Michael Dukakis to counter Willie Horton was with an atypical instance of the Bush furlough program malfunctioning. There was one case during the Reagan-Bush years in which a convicted drug dealer jumped a work release transfer, which you could call a furlough. In fact, the federal government does call it a type of furlough, and raped and murdered the pregnant Hispanic mother of two. When we said to our focus groups, now let's talk about this instance, this vicious drug dealer whom George Bush says he'd like to execute, manages to get out of a federal furlough and kills not just a woman, he kills the pregnant mother of two. Now you could displace Willie Horton, but look what you've done. You've now taken demagoguery to pit against demagoguery, taken an atypical instance against an atypical instance, and the discussion has now degenerated to futility. And lost in the process is a reasoned discussion of the reason for furloughs and the relationship between furloughs and reduction in crime.
Well, since you agree that some of the same principles that were at work in the Willie Horton campaign are now at work in how the Republicans are trying to smear Hillary Clinton and working women and pro-choice women and homosexuals, what do you think the Democrats should do to counter that?
As an academic who would like to see discourse elevated, I would like to believe that laying in place the context for the Hillary Clinton statements and the historical trajectory of those arguments would establish convincingly to people that Hillary Clinton is in the mainstream. Her positions are not controversial. Indeed, they are the norms for behavior in courts now. As a person who studied this, I know that won't work. Michael Dukakis tried that in 1988 when he said, "Here are the Supreme Court rulings that I relied on in saying I wouldn't mandate the Pledge of Allegiance in classrooms." And he was basically skewered on the assumption that he was unpatriotic. He didn't want little children to say the pledge. Strategically, what my research would suggest is the way for the Democrats to effectively get rid of the Republican charge is to say the Republicans favor having little children tied to radiators, sexually abused and starved with no legal recourse because they don't believe that children under 18 are entitled to lawyers. Now, look what that recommendation does. It takes the worst-case scenario, the non-representative case, and pits it against the evocative claim that 12-year-olds will be permitted to sue for their allowance. The discourse isn't advancing in a useful way if the Democrats respond that way, but in fact, that's the way that will work, and that's the problem with the discourse of campaigns.
In your book, you said that the Willie Horton ads played on fears without stating what those fears were. Mm-hmm. And that's a tactic of a lot of negative campaign mm-hmm. ads. Do you see that at work now in how working women and homosexuals are being portrayed?
The claims at the Republican convention that Bill Clinton would approve same-sex marriages basically overstates the Clinton position substantially and plays on fears that are not ever discussed in the public domain. First, Bill Clinton says what he favors is non-discrimination in employment, and he favors access to the military for those who are avowedly gay. He has not taken a position about sanctifying, that's the Republican word, same-sex marriages. The problem with the Republican claim that he would approve same-sex marriages is that it plays on fears that no one discusses. When you say you oppose same-sex marriages and you are a conservative fundamentalist Republican, what are you actually saying? You're claiming that you're afraid that you're going to have children adopted into a same-sex relationship, that you've set up a role model for what the fundamentalists consider an alternative lifestyle that is inappropriate. That claim is usually conjoined with a second claim, which is the Democrats would mandate gay teachers in the classroom. What that implies but does not say is pedophilia. It suggests that gays are necessarily rapacious and predatory. Now, usually the image that's called up is of the male teacher in the elementary classroom. The number of male teachers in elementary classrooms is very small. Why not equally often, or more often, since heterosexuals make up 90% of the population, fear that what you're going to have are heterosexual males preying on little girls? But there's a fear that is not discussed. The base in evidence is never put forward. So instead of asking, how likely is it that a gay teacher is going to molest the children in her or his charge in a school, we simply play out the unspoken fear, mandating gay teachers. We also suggest that if you have a gay teacher in the classroom, what you're going to have is advocacy of a gay lifestyle for children and the assumption that a gay lifestyle is contagious. And then finally, there's the fear of AIDS. Now, what is interesting about all of this is the unspoken pedophilia, molesting children, advocating homosexuality being contagious. The whole notion that what you may have here is a subtle means of transmitting AIDS will never be spoken in the public discourse. If they were spoken in the public discourse, we would have a chance to turn to the experts and say, is that what happens? What are the percents? How likely is that? Is there ever a conceivable circumstance in which a teacher would transmit AIDS to a student? In the process, if we could get this into the public domain, people would have a chance to examine their fears.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Kathleen Hall Jamison, and she's the author of the new book, Dirty Politics, Deception, Distraction, and Democracy. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Kathleen Hall Jamison. She's an expert on political campaigns and a professor at the Annenberg School of Communication at the University of Pennsylvania, author of the new book, Dirty Politics. We are living in a climate in which it would be totally unacceptable for a candidate to get up and say, I believe all black people in America are inferior and should not be granted their civil rights. Now, you might use code words to mm-hmm. play on people's racist fears, but those racist fears would definitely be unexpressed in a real concrete way. Mm-hmm. You couldn't get away with it, no matter how racist you were. You can, however, get up and say that you think homosexuals should not be given civil rights. Mm-hmm. Why can you get away with that with one group and not another?
Part of what I look at in Dirty Politics is the history of scapegoating in presidential campaigns. And what I think is clear in the ways in which we've treated, for example, Catholics and the way in which we've treated blacks is that over a long period of time, extended discourse exposes the substance of the fears, and extended experience with the scapegoated group suggests the fears are illegitimate. Part of what the gay rights movement has done is legitimized individuals coming forward and saying, yes, I am gay. And to the extent that in the workplace, in the neighborhood, at church, individuals are now having experience with people who seem very much like them in fundamental ways and are realizing this person is gay, we are moving into the transitional period in which it is far more difficult to vilify gays than it was before you could make those identifications.
The Bush campaign is using a degree of negative campaigning to attack the Democrats, mm-hmm. describing the Democrats' platform as being like Woody Allen's personal life and so on. Clinton maintains he's trying to run a positive campaign. What do you think? Do you think he is running a, quote, positive campaign?
Clinton is running a positive campaign more so than are the Republicans, if what you look at for negativity and positivity, if there's such a word, is attack on person rather than attack on policy. But if you ask how many lines in the speeches of Bill Clinton attack the policies and the record of George Bush, you would say that the two campaigns are comparably oppositional. Our tendency, however, is not to think that attacks on policy are negative, but rather to think that attacks on groups and on persons are. And so many people hear the attacks that are characterized as family values attacks as negative simply by virtue of their nature, where they don't hear the public policy attacks as being negative by their nature. And what is interesting about the distinction is this. We don't yet have a clear answer to the question, what's relevant to governance about the character of the person who would be president? The Republicans are gambling that ultimately before you cast a vote, you ask, do I trust this person? Is the character of this candidate acceptable to me morally, ethically, and on whatever dimensions I as a person value? The Democrats are assuming that we go into the voting booth and say, what public policies matter to me? Basically, the two campaigns, in other words, are contesting on different grounds, and they have a different view of how voters make voting decisions.
Well, from your research, which view is more accurate?
Depends on how troubled the economy is. If we walk into the voting booth in early November perceiving that the economy is not picking up, the future is not brighter and better, we are more likely to value the public policy positions on the economy of the person out of power. If the economy appears to be picking up, and our faith in George Bush's economic strategy is revivified, then the character dimension is going to be salient, because basically what we're going to say is, who do I trust to do all those things we haven't talked about that we can't even anticipate that may happen in the first term of this person I'm now putting in the Oval Office? Bush is gambling on the latter scenario. Clinton's gambling on the former.
If you put on an ad with false claims in it for a product, mm-hmm. the Federal Trade Commission will make you take the ad off mm-hmm. or correct the information. If you put on a political ad that is based on completely false claims, nobody's going to make you take it off or make you correct mm-hmm. it. The press will try to correct it on their mm-hmm. news shows or in the newspaper, but the ad can continue to run. Do you think that there should be some kind of formal way of regulating campaign ads?
No, I don't. And that's not because I'm not offended by much of what I see in political advertising. It rather is a fear rooted in history. Prior to the regulation of broadcasting that required that a candidate's ads be aired, the station owners of radio routinely turned down the ads of the candidates they didn't favor. Now, since station owners tended to be Republicans, that meant the Democratic ads were routinely quashed. But the larger question that's raised when one says, let's keep all ads that lie off the air is, who do you trust to determine whether an ad is lying? Who do you trust to be so unbiased and so fair that that person wouldn't be playing games with the political process? What is unfortunate is that many people believe that because an ad airs on television, it must have gone through some screening process and it must as a result be true. The service we can provide is to remind viewers that an ad can lie outrageously. The station can know it is lying. And if the station has permitted one candidate for that office to buy time, it must permit all comparable candidates to buy time. And it may not censor the ad unless the ad violates the time limits that have been purchased, the technical requirements of the station, the sound breaks up in the ad, or the ad is obscene. It shows a copulating couple, for example. No, you can't do that. Or it doesn't have the disclaimer at the end that says who sponsored it. Those are the only reasons a station can reject an ad.
Kathleen, would you ever like to get into campaign managing yourself? You know so much about campaigning and politics and the way it's practiced in America.
No. There's a role for the academic community in the campaign process. And I worry when my colleagues move in and out of campaign consulting.
Why?
Because what the academic community should do is stay as genuinely nonpartisan as it can and stay focused on the process, not the individuals involved in the process. And so I see my role and the role of my colleagues who study political communication as asking how we talk to the public and to the press about making the system work more effectively. Now, if my agenda were electing George Bush, I would write a very different book than I would if my focus were on trying to determine how a campaign best helps the electorate understand the issues and helps ensure that campaigns have relevance to governance.
Have you ever been approached by a campaign?
Yes, I've been approached by campaigns on both sides. It's interesting to play the role that I do because Democrats assume that I'm a Democrat except when I attack their candidates' campaign strategy or their communication. Republicans assume I'm a Republican except when I attack them. And while they're assuming that I'm with them, I occasionally get asked if I'd like to work for them or give them advice, and I always say no.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking to us about the campaign. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Kathleen Hall Jamison is the author of Dirty Politics and the dean of the Annenberg School of Communications at the University of Pennsylvania. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.